Hey, y'all, when the polls close on Super Tuesday, join the Jasons and the whole WFAA team for a one-of-a-kind look at how Texans voted. Download the WFAA Plus streaming app on your smart TV to watch their Election Night Results Special, Tuesday, March 5th. Hey, y'all, this is where Texas politics gets interesting. Here again are two guys named Jason, some great guests, and cold Texas beer for another smart conversation on Yolitics, the unofficial political podcast of Texas.
Hey, everybody, we are back with another episode of Yolitics. We were on the subject of Mexico and Texas last week, and we just couldn't get enough. So we're back at it.
Well, yeah, there's a lot going on, you know.
Except this time you didn't bring the cerveza or the tacos or the quesadilla like we had last week.
We're a little tight on time, so I'm not going to break out the cerveza. So we are at the Bush Institute. Did I get that right?
Mm-hmm. Bush Center, isn't it?
We'll send you the boilerplate, but
I should have asked that before we started the recording here.
This is the Bush Institute. We're the policy arm of the George W. Bush Presidential Center.
I'm glad we got all of it in there. Yeah. I like that.
Well, let's just dive into it here because we have two guests with us, and one of them you may remember from previous episodes. We have Laura Collins here. She is the director of the Bush Institute SMU Economic Growth Initiative at the George W. Bush Institute.
Yes.
Gotcha. That was a mouthful,
well
speaking
done.
Of that.
Making sure I have it right.
We also have Jennifer Aperti, right?
Yes.
Aperti,
yes.
The deputy director of the Texas-Mexico Center at SMU, Southern Methodist University, here in Dallas. And that name is Italian.
Yes.
Okay, was that proper Italian that I did there?
Very nice.
I tried to raise my fingers just right when I said it.
So it's Aperti for the rest of us,
yes.
A-P-P-E-R-T-I. You're the director of the Texas-Mexico Center. At SMU, right?
Yes.
Gotcha. All right. Well.
Oh, I said deputy. I demoted you here.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
That's for the my other cabs. It's confusing.
You're also deputy director of the Tower Center.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow.
I knew that was in there somewhere. Everybody's got a long title here.
Yeah. Ours are pretty simple. Yeah.
Very simple.
We envy you that.
Yeah, exactly. We ask questions. So we're back on the topic of Mexico. 2024. This is, the border's the boogeyman as far as the Republican Party today is concerned. And they've done a really good job framing this issue to get the electorate behind them, at least the Republican primary voters behind them. Here's what I've been curious about, though. And Jennifer, we'll start with you, because prior to joining SMU, you spent, a decade as a diplomat for the Mexican government, worked in Uruguay for the embassy of Mexico, and you have a lot of experience on that. So let's start with you. I'm curious. What do Mexicans think about what's happening north of the border? All the hot air that's going on up here. Do they look at us and roll their eyes? Are they concerned about anything going on up here?
Well, not a simple question. I would say when you ask Americans what they think about Mexican politics, you're going to get a diversity of opinions.
Yeah.
I would argue the same thing around. Mm-hmm. Mexicans also have very different opinions. I think it's a big if, they're paying attention. Because right now, Mexico is also preparing for a very big election mm-hmm. on June the 1st. So a lot of Mexicans right now are mostly spending their attention on Mexican politics. However, I recently had the chance to speak with business people, and I would say they are a big part of the U.S.-Mexico relationship.
This was in Tampico?
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. And that...
He's going to be doing this all episode, by the way. He'll be dropping this.
Anytime I can get an accent right, I'm going to interrupt to do that. And you have family down that way, so you were down there and you're speaking with business leaders, and this was supposed to be about business.
It was. And one of the things that came up, of course, was, well, how is business going to look after the election in the U.S.? Mm. Oddly enough, despite what rhetoric might be, people are not really worried about whoever wins in the U.S. will probably continue the great economic relationship both countries have. Hmm. So most of the concerns are actually what I mentioned in terms of rhetoric, the image of Mexico and Mexicans in the U.S. But interestingly, I think the economic relationship has been working so well that despite politics on both sides of the border, everybody is reassured that that will continue going no matter who or what.
I wonder if there's like real strong feelings, though, about some of the initiatives that have been undertaken by Texas specifically, where you've got razor wire along the border, you've got, you know, buoys floating in the middle of the border there, you've got some real militarization going on along the border to try to stop the flow of migrants. Are people talking about that down there? They're talking about it a lot here, or maybe it's just because we've been so bombarded with ads.
So I would say most of the people in Mexico who are paying a lot of attention to that are the border communities. And I would add a different element to it. This is very new for the Mexican communities along the border. Something that here in the U.S. we've seen throughout many years due to immigrants coming in through the border for many years now. Ever since the pandemic, when a lot of them have now been staying on the Mexican side, the first communities who received the impact of that were Mexican border communities. Cities like Matamoros, Reynosa, even further along out of Texas, but all throughout the border. Let's not forget that the largest border between the U.S. and Mexico is in Texas. So yeah, a lot of the Mexican cities on the other side of our border are the first ones feeling the impact. They were not used to receiving people. They might have seen them for many years, stay there for a while, trying to cross. Whether people were successful in doing so or deported to their origin countries was a different story, but it didn't really affect their everyday lives. Now we've got people waiting on those cities for very long periods of time. This is not something that those cities were used to. This is completely new for those communities, and they are the ones mostly focusing on, okay, what's going to happen in the U.S.? How is that going to impact our communities?
Well, yeah, Laura, I'll get plenty of questions for you, but you just raised another point there. So these Mexican border towns are feeling the impact now of the U.S. border policies. Is that changing any political views of the folks in these towns? Are they saying, you know, forget the wall here, guys, or the maquiladoras, or, you know, we're tied to you guys economically, but, you know, something needs to happen here. Something needs to give.
Definitely. One of the things that we're noticing, and in fact, our researchers are working on this right now, how can they, as cities, do something about it? Because just like in the U.S., in Mexico, anything having to do with immigration, that's a federal mandate. So it should be the federal government taking care of this. Recently, Mexico's government decided they were going to cut the funding for Mexico's National Institute for Migration, which is the entity in charge of funding anything related to immigration. So these communities became very worried. Like, if we already have something that we're not used to that's big for us and that we as a city don't know how to handle, with less funding available than before, how are we going to do it? So a lot of cities are starting to reach out, ask questions to NGOs, to cities across the border, to state governments. What can we do together? And this is why at the center, we firmly believe that we need more U.S.-Mexico cooperation. But if it's not happening at the federal level, maybe we can get it started at local levels. Given the experience a lot of Texan cities have had throughout decades, maybe there are some good shared practices they can share with their Mexican counterparts that might be helpful.
I wonder how much people on the other side of the border might have been watching the recent politics here in the U.S. around immigration. As we all know, the Senate, you know, had hammered out this big compromise, Republicans and Democrats really working hard on this thing. And they thought, okay, we've got a big deal here. And then it just died in the House. And, you know, it's been widely reported that former President Trump wants to run on the immigration issue and persuaded the House to shut that thing down. Laura, does this ever get fixed? If, you know, it seems like we've always got another election in front of us, and this has become a political football. Can this ever be fixed? We've heard about this path to citizenship thing for eons now.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. First, I want to say, though, that the fact that Mexico cut their migration budget is actually really scary because, as you know, they already had a very small budget for humanitarian resettlement. And so as a receiving country now, they take asylum seekers as well. I mean, just the fact that overall immigration is cut, let alone that humanitarian budget, really scary. And your point about cross-border and the NGOs, you know, we have such a great tradition here of migrant shelters and faith-based organizations at the border really working hard to welcome folks because they've had to, right? The U.S. government, we process people, we release them We detain them. We don't welcome them. That's not what the U.S. government does. And so it's interesting to see that be a new sort of dynamic in Mexico. And, you know, it's those are the organizations that do such a great job. I mean, Annunciation House is one example. They've been in the news a lot lately, especially in the last week in El Paso. They've been there for 48 years welcoming migrants. You know, they work closely with the U.S. government when migrants are released from custody. They've done this across multiple administrations. And right now they're in some legal hot water with the Attorney General's office. We'll see what happens with that case. I know there was a hearing today. It'd be really sad to see organizations like theirs not able to exist anymore, because we know they do such a good part of the welcoming. And you know, they're an example, I think, that we can look to as a group of people that have always worked, no matter who's in power in the United States, no matter what the immigration policies look like. They find a way to make it work. They find a way to serve people. They find a way to adapt to what policies look like. And they've seen the way that immigration policy has changed over the last 50 years.
Mm. Well, yeah, let's lay that out here. The Attorney General in Texas sued Annunciation House and essentially said, hey, you're doing, you know, serving undocumented immigrants, and you shouldn't be doing it. Is kind of the 30,000 foot view here. There are a lot of those NGOs, these non-governmental organizations up and down the Rio Grande doing the exact same thing. And these people have been there for a half century.
Yeah.
This is going to have a chilling effect.
Yeah. What is the effect? Is it a chilling effect? Or are these churches, Catholic charities, others?
They're faith-based organizations mostly. Some of them are not. And, you know, what they provide is, you know, these are the migrants that they primarily serve, at least according to what we've known from what they say, is they serve migrants who have been processed and detained by U.S. authorities and released. Those people have a notice to appear. They have a court date. They're sent on their way, and they're basically pointed in the direction of the bus station and said, go for it. So this is an organization that takes them in, gives them a place to sleep, gives them a meal, helps them find their bus. Pretty basic humanitarian relief. If you don't have organizations in the private sector doing that, then you end up with people sleeping on the streets until they can find their way to their next destination. Sometimes cities take on that burden and try to shelter them. We've seen what happens when you have a city like New York City that has a mandate to house these people. So they serve an incredibly important role, not just in helping migrants, but in helping the communities that they're already living in and serving in, because they make that process work a little bit better.
Well, the fact that they've been sued, though, doesn't that give us an idea when we look at the gauge of immigration policy that we've moved quite clearly?
Because they've
been there for a long time.
They've been there for a long time. I feel like the temperature on the conversation is really hot right now, in a way that, you know, if you'd asked me a few years ago, I would have said, oh no, we've had horrible rhetoric about immigrants for decades in the United States, right? It's never, you know, you look at the really old comics and stuff from the quota years when they didn't really want Eastern European immigrants in the United States. And I could have told you then that that was way worse. And I'm not sure that's true anymore, because we're at the point now where it's not just the rhetoric. So little immigration policy gets done in Congress anymore that now immigration policy is primarily made in the courts, because Congress doesn't really do anything. And then the executive branch tries to act within what they have, because the system needs to work. Right now, the legal immigration system doesn't work. So when that doesn't work, executive branch tries to act. Sometimes they act in a more progressive manner. Sometimes they act in a more anti-immigrant manner. Either way, someone's there to challenge it. So immigration policy is made primarily in the courts. It's been the way from the last 5+ years. It's a horrible way to make immigration policy. Nobody wins. And it creates this backlash. The agency personnel are constantly dealing with changing rules. The migrants are constantly dealing with changing rules. Mexico is constantly dealing with changing rules. The only winners are the smuggling organizations, because they can then turn around and go, well, you know, under Title 42, for example, which we've talked about before, when we weren't going to take you in for asylum as the United States, we would just dump you back in Mexico. They said, okay, well, we'll give you a 3-to-1 deal, right? Or a 4-to-1 deal. We'll keep trying to cross you for a fee until you can successfully get across. And so those smuggling organizations are really entrepreneurial and smart. Mm. They know what the loopholes are, and they find a way to exploit them. And if we had actual legislative change on immigration policy, we'd see less of that.
It was close, and we saw the Republican senator from Oklahoma, James Lankford, negotiating on behalf of Republicans, and then he got you know, rolled over by the bus, the GOP bus on this. It kind of surprised me. I didn't expect that to happen. I'm just curious what you thought about that, what happened with the bipartisan deal. And secondly, if that won't happen, we already see Biden moving to the right on this issue in an election year. Can anything happen when it comes to immigration?
Yeah, so I think the thing that was kind of interesting to me about the border supplemental is I question the political wisdom from multiple people to decide to pair the foreign assistance with the border piece.
Yeah, the Ukraine and Israeli aid.
Yes.
With,
yeah. Both of those are pretty volatile topics. I think that there was a conventional wisdom that if you paired them, you know, it would be so important to get that funding across for Ukraine and their fight against Russia that would just, it would force people to be a little bit more reasonable on a border vote. That's not what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the senators that worked on that were very sincere in their efforts and they worked really hard on it. It was not a perfect compromise. There were policy elements of it that I would not have supported. There were policy elements of it that I did support. But it was a good start, and it was a really interesting framework. And I would say even a new paradigm. You know, in the past, it was always border security for relief for the undocumented, and this wasn't. This was border policy and also some changes on legal immigration that would have done a few tweaks on expanding the number of people who could come here on green cards. And that's a really positive way to look at that. We know the legal immigration side has to work for the border side to work. They go together. The House had already passed something that they like better. That was just border, which personal opinion, that's not good policy. That wouldn't have worked. And they dug in their positions. Mm. So that's really where that sits. And, you know, until they decide that it's worth it to them to have a functioning legal immigration system, we're going to continue to see Congress.
It's not worth it, though, because they can campaign on it forever.
I believe that public servants should be doing things for the good of the country, right? Mm. And the tension, I think, for some of these folks is that they may not have decided to run because they care a lot about immigration policy. Mm. They may care a lot about tax policy or healthcare policy or something else. And so taking a tough vote on something that they don't care as much about puts them in a tough position. But ultimately, we need an immigration system that benefits the United States, that works to support our 21st century economy, ensures our future prosperity and vitality. And so hopefully that eventually wins out.
I think this just shows us again, though, that things have certainly moved from what we were dealing with even just a handful of years ago, because for a long time, you know, the debate was about dreamers and about path to citizenship and so forth.
This isn't
even
like,
about
for 20
that.
Years, we had bipartisan legislation on dreamers and just never could get through Congress. And
This was about beefing up border security. I mean, with none of that stuff.
Well, and the money that was in the border supplemental piece, let alone the package deal about the changes to the law, but just the money was needed just to make current law function at a bare minimum. And that doesn't exist right now.
And can't even get that through.
Right.
Do you roll your eyes when you watch this stuff?
All the time. I mean, I think, though, that, you know, yes, there are definitely times when I roll my eyes, but I also... You can't laugh too much at it because it's so serious.
It's a legitimate issue. Yeah.
You know, and it has to get done. And I also have to have some optimism. If I don't have optimism about it, then it's impossible to do this job, right? Yeah. Because you just see things, good pieces of legislation fail on a frequent basis.
Jenny, are you optimistic?
I am. And
are you?
And getting back to the what can we do, I'm not optimistic about the situation now. I'm optimistic about what could be done. And this is where I think we could also get a little bit creative. And I'm going to go back to this part about our partners in Mexico and the border and border communities. Time is of the essence. And you just asked the question, what can we do? I think a lot of people on different sectors are asking themselves the same question. If we don't see something over here on the political arenas move on either side of the border, people are just going to move on. This is why we've seen states take certain actions. And even, like I mentioned, in Mexico, we're seeing local communities take action. So I'm not saying that that is ideal, but I think there might be ways there to do things. And like I said, I really believe in U.S.-Mexico cooperation, that I will always believe that you can do something along those lines that might be helpful. It's not going to solve everything. But if we can at least move a couple of steps forward, that's better than nothing. Mm-hmm. And so right now, because we are seeing a huge amount of people on our shared border. Let's not forget the border belongs to two countries. This is our shared border. I feel that sometimes both countries take a stand on, well, the border this and, oh, the border that. We kind of forget it's a shared border. Maybe we should start talking about a shared management of the border that might be more helpful than each country trying to come up and do things their own way. If we start by supporting those local communities along the Texas border that are seeing an influx of people, I think if we start with shared practices, that might lead us to say, okay, maybe we can city by city manage somewhat better the influx of people while we decide countrywide what to do about it.
We have the international treaty with the water in the Rio Grande, but what would a shared management of a border look like?
For starters, I would argue, leave it at technical levels. Through the State Department and the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, I think you have excellent bodies of qualified people that might be able to engage in dialogue, engage with local communities, and have like a discussion group.
Wait,
or
what?
Or a work group.
Take the politics
yes.
out of the border? Wow.
You're very optimistic, Jenny. You're very optimistic.
We have to be like
border communities already take the politics out of the border, right? Because it's a
they live it every day.
Yeah. Exactly.
But I'm also curious, you know, at what point does the politics, at least in the U.S., impact the wallets of people in the U.S.? Because we love to badmouth the border, build the wall, keep, you know, Mexicans out and you know, people coming up here from Venezuela and different places like that. At some point, I worry that the politics is going to sour business. Are you concerned about that?
I love that you mentioned, yes, we talk about the border as if it's only about one issue, but the border is about so many issues. Economics plays a huge part. Mm-hmm. And just to mention, you know, we love eating fresh produce, right? Well, 60% of the produce that comes into the U.S. comes from Mexico through the bridge in FAR, Texas. So when we talk about
60%
from in FAR, Texas,
yeah,
of all the fruits and veggies that come into the U.S.,
there's another.
How many lanes are at that bridge?
Jeez. Oof, I can't remember at the top of my head, but. Yeah. It is one of the most efficient ones in terms of produce
That's
and
amazing.
Handling frozen. It's amazing. You have other bridges along the entire border, but number one for that is here in Texas.
Wow.
So even when we're thinking, well, closing borders, oh, so that means that from one day to the other, we have the potential of not receiving 60% of the produce we buy every day at the grocery store.
And this stuff can rot.
Exactly.
Yeah.
These are the dimensions of things that sometimes we don't measure when we think about, oh, closing borders. Or borders are not only about people. They're about infrastructure. They are about, like you mentioned, the economy.
We've heard that rhetoric, though, closing the border in this election season. And no avocados, no tomatoes, no, I mean, you're going to.
And no trade. Do we really want to impact business? Because over 60% of trade between the U.S. and Mexico happens in Texas, in the Port of Laredo. Do we really also want to impact all of the businesses throughout the country? I don't know.
It's the automotive supply chain too, right? If you have an American-made car, is a supply chain between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico, and if you close the border, you're imperiling that supply chain.
And let's explore this just for a moment here, because people talk about it and you hear it a lot in quick political sound bites. What would it physically mean to close the border for a month? Let's say what would that happen? What would happen to me in Texas here?
Okay, for starters.
You've been waiting to talk about
this. This is going to be such an ugly picture.
Let's say for a month, 30 days, border closed, like some politicians want.
We'll start with what I believe is basic, which is food. We all get hungry at one point. We've got to eat. Very soon, you'd start seeing, oh, I can't find tomatoes here anymore. Oh, there's no more berries. I've got to go to a different supermarket. You start seeing less and less of the things you need to eat. Not only in your supermarket for your home, but then that means also you're impacting all the restaurants. Hey, no, we're out of all these dishes because we can't find all the ingredients to produce this with. You start affecting an industry like the restaurant industry, which here in Dallas, for example, is so important for our local economy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm guessing that if you don't have customers because you can't supply them with what you sell, you're going to have to maybe start telling some people, well, I can't pay you this month, so I'm sorry, I'm going to have to let you go. it all spirals. I'm only touching right now produce, as you see. But like Laura mentioned, what happens when we are talking about building cell phones, computers, which is something that crosses the border multiple times, and it really is part of what Texas builds together as part of the U.S. with Mexico. Tech industry is already going to start saying, wait, I'm missing some of the parts that needed to come through. What's happening? So you're impacting the tech industry.
Cars are huge.
Exactly.
You thought it was got crazy expensive in the pandemic. Imagine shutting all of that down.
How bad it could get after. So life would become even more expensive and you would have less options as a consumer. For starters.
Not to mention, I guess, the housing industry, the hospitality industry, the restaurant industry, the labor a lot of times that runs those. I mean, imagine that.
I mean, so I actually think you can't actually shut the border down because in a certain way, people are still going to try to find their way in, right? Mm. And so it's rhetoric when they say shut the border down. It may mean that they don't want to take any asylum seekers. That just means that when we catch people, we're going to put them in deportation proceedings and then try to return them to their home countries, which is dependent upon cooperation from the home country, right? Our ability to turn people away and leave them in Mexico and wait for their case there is dependent upon Mexico's hospitality. If they don't want to do it, we can't turn them away. So it's a lot of bluster. It's a lot of bluster. There is a real risk that we would lose the ability, depending on Congress or the next administration, to be a welcoming humanitarian country and a refuge for people fleeing violence and persecution if they change the asylum laws. But the idea that suddenly if they decide to shut the border down, no one would cross, I think is foolish. Mm.
Jen, you mentioned June 1st, we've got a big election coming up in Mexico for the next president of Mexico. We're going to have a woman president. President in Mexico,
for
are we
sure.
not?
Sure, exactly.
So Mexico is going to beat the U.S. To that.
Yes.
So first of all, there's that.
I mean,
big...
who knows? Who knows? But
yeah, there's that. Big... You never know. I guess. But that's one of the big dynamics. The other, though, is I'm curious. Just we know that immigration is huge in this election here in the U.S. We know that the border is huge in this election. Is this something that plays that big in Mexico?
Not as much.
Okay.
Not as much because Mexico's right now focusing a lot on its domestic issues in terms of what both majority or the two main candidates are presenting. But it's not such a big topic as it is in the U.S. because of the way immigration has been historically in Mexico up until very recently. Mm-hmm. Mexico used to be primarily a country that sent immigrants abroad. And for the longest time, it stayed that way. So throughout the different Mexican administrations, the country built systems in which to better communicate with Mexicans abroad or try to generate communication between communities who expelled a lot of immigrants and trying to, at some point facilitate maybe people coming back or how do we focus on remittances, which are such a huge part of Mexico's
economy.
Sending
money back home, yeah.
So that had been the traditional pattern up until the late, I would say, maybe 2015. We started to see maybe not so many Mexicans come to the U.S. as in many previous years. 2020 was definitely a year where things started to change for Mexico. Now, because it all started with the pandemic. Mm-hmm. Okay, for health reasons, people are going to wait on the Mexican side. That's how we started with where we are today. Mm-hmm. And it's been that way for a couple of years now. But in a very short period of time, Mexico has transitioned from being primarily a country that sends immigrants abroad versus one that's now receiving them.
From south. Point south.
Mm-hmm. Not only Central America, we are starting to see people arrive at the Mexican border from places like China. Mm-hmm. That is unheard of in Mexico, at least along the border.
Lots of Africans.
Exactly.
There's a Muslim-focused shelter in Tijuana, I believe, because of the number of Muslim immigrants that are coming to the border.
Hmm. Well, what's the reaction then politically?
So that's the thing. The first people starting to become aware and say, wait, we have changing conditions, we don't know what to do about them, are the border communities who are receiving them. But I don't think this has become much of a topic in the rest of Mexico yet, as it has become in the border communities, which is why it's not going to play the same role as in the Mexican election as it will in the U.S. election. However, who knows what will happen in the upcoming Mexican election.
How crucial is it for Mexico to enforce immigration, though? It can really change the dynamic of what of how many people, I guess, come north of the border there, can't it?
It's complex, to say the least.
Really complicated question.
Because, yes, for starters, that would be if we only stick to the topic of immigration.
Right.
But when you're...
Asylum, though, is a different...
When you're dealing in a bilateral relationship, there's other topics that, you know, come into play. And sometimes, if you don't have a card on this, but you do have a card here, you're going to try to leverage that. So...
I've heard somebody, an expert, say that Mexico will either help us on immigration or drugs, but not both. And I think that's probably a bit of an absolute. But there is a limit, even as good a relationship as we have with Mexico and as close as we are economically, there's a limit to how much they'll cooperate with us.
Go back to that. Why is it? This is a good conversation. Why is that, though? I wonder. Just, hey, Mexico will help on one thing, maybe not the other.
I mean, it's just, I think a lot of it depends on the relationship between the administrations. And also, you know, Mexico, I think, wants to make sure it has its own identity, right? I mean, they're an independent country, too, and they are not going to just take direction from the United States. And they also take issue with us on, you know, we have a problem on the border of blaming Mexico for drugs coming across. They blame us for guns coming across.
People forget that.
Yeah.
Let's get back to the election.
Wait, one more thing on that. Pulling on that thread a little bit more. What is the leverage that Mexico gains by saying, well, you want us to cooperate on this? Then
so
what is the leverage there?
Going back to rhetoric and also what you just mentioned, right? There's been sometimes a sense in Mexico that, we're supposed to be partners. We're all members of USMCA. Sometimes we feel like a lesser partner in this relationship, even though we, you know, are trying to comply with a lot of the rules as best as we can, even though we, you know, try as, you know, send our best produce, for example, and you know, we try and do all these things. But sometimes, you know, when we get told, you're not cooperating because, you know, there's so many drugs flowing up north. Wait a second. It turns out that you're telling me all these to-dos, but I'm not seeing anything in return. And one of the things that...
And it's your addictions, by the way, that are causing the drugs to come up north. Yeah.
It's tied to violence. So one of the things that this present administration took very seriously was, well, guess what? I've been asking you for a very long time, help me not to get weapons illegally into this country. But I'm not seeing anything in return. So why don't we first work on, you know, some of these issues, then we'll work later on these. So it becomes a matter of priorities, and that's the thing. Two countries might have different priorities. How do you bring them towards something that they can both work on?
And that's where frameworks that already exist, like USMCA, are so important because we already have that existing relationship. And so that's one way that we know that we can work well together. It's proven. We know we work well with Canada and that too, but it's not perfect, and it's never perfect because everybody has their own priorities.
Laura, it sounds like you all need to organize a big summit here between some leaders, maybe here at the Bush Presidential Center.
We're always happy to convene folks as we can, but I'm not going to make any promises. I don't know that anyone would answer my invitation if it came from me. So,
Now they've heard it on this podcast.
They're going to call me.
Exactly. You know, we've heard about the guns being traced back. We'll stay on the guns just for a moment. The guns being traced back from, you know, crimes and somewhere in Mexico back to places in the U.S. Does the U.S. do anything to try to stop guns? I mean, I've been to the border many times, and I mean, they, you know, they wave people through. You push a button, sometimes pay a quarter or whatever it is, and go on through. Are we doing anything?
So I can't comment as to what we actually do. Because my only experience with this is in a past job, I had to monitor the hearings for the House Oversight Committee related to some programs, some operations that were supposed to catch gun smugglers. So I know we do some things. I don't know specifically what we do. And I've tried really hard not to pay attention to that because I did not enjoy watching those hearings.
I can imagine.
My favorite use of time.
These cartels are very well armed, yeah. And these are American arms in many cases.
No, yes, and there's a reason for that. In Mexico, people, unless it's maybe a hunting rifle, they have to go through very specific permits. You even have to get it from the military. It's not easy.
Yeah.
People cannot access weapons easily at all. So the fact that they are so well armed, sometimes with weapons that the military in Mexico hasn't even had access to yet, tells you that they're getting them illegally here in the U.S. So this is why the Mexican government decided, you know, we're going to file a civil lawsuit for damages against U.S. gun manufacturers. It's the manufacturers, because in that sense, like, we do not want to even think about telling people what to do in their own country. We just want to say, hey, there, and it's also, they didn't do this for all gun manufacturers. Mm-hmm. They've been tracing, oh, look, there's a pattern here. Mm-hmm. So it's certain gun manufacturers that they filed this lawsuit
that they think are not
against,
stopping certain big buyers from turning around and dumping those guns in Mexico.
But this just goes back to say, this is a priority in Mexico. And for example, if this is the focus, they're going to do that versus maybe say, oh, let's see what we can do at the southern border with Central America in terms of immigration. Mm. So it's terms of priorities.
Here's the last question for both of you guys. And let's go back to the female who's going to be elected as the next Mexican president, the mayor of Mexico City, Claudia Sheinbaum, and I think a senator named, is it Xochitl?
Xochitl Galvez.
Galvez. How does that change anything? I know both of these women stand for different things, but as far as cooperation with the U.S. goes, do you expect any changes at all? Laura, I'll start with you.
I mean, that's so dependent. And I will admit, I have not followed very much either of these candidates. So much of this depends on the willingness of not just the Mexican president, but the United States president to prioritize that relationship. And I know that, you know, I was in college during the Bush administration. I do know, though, that that was a priority for the Bush administration, was that relationship. And I believe, I think it was Vicente Fox, was the first state visit of the Bush administration. So that it matters a lot, whether the U.S. wants to prioritize it. Obviously, Mexico has to as well.
I would say, even though, because recently Mexican law changed, they cannot speak to what each of their plans are until a certain point in time. So I think right now, as the campaigning will go, they will now be able to tell more about what each of their plans are. So far, I don't have a clear indication, but again, listening to business people, they're so aware in Mexico about the importance of the economic relationship. And yes, since now Mexico is the US's main trading partner, I think it would be hard for either of them if they did not want to continue US cooperation. They might not be interested at a personal level. I don't know this, but even if one of them or both of them were not so interested, the conditions in the country are such that they're going to have to address how do we further cooperate with the U.S.
Do the political ads there get as nasty as they do here?
Political ads are the same, I think, in many places.
Really? Okay.
Maybe a shorter time period, given the restrictions on what you can say. Yeah.
But
maybe we ought to think about that here, right?
Never do that.
Too much money to be made, right?
I have a last question for you all as well, but they're different questions for each. Laura, I'll start with you. You all put out this blueprint to elected leaders in this country saying, here's how you can fix the immigration system, and you gave all of these different big priorities. Obviously, the Republican Party has changed tremendously from when George W. Bush was president. I'm curious, when you all put stuff like this out, do you hear from Republicans, from elected leaders or party officials? Do you hear from Democrats? Have you heard from anybody on this?
We definitely hear from policymakers, and we hear from people on both sides of the aisle. And the reason for that is, while we are nonpartisan and we definitely have a perspective, and the man whose name on the door obviously, you know, drives that, everyone is familiar with what President Bush and Mrs. Bush stood for when they were in office on immigration. It's a values-driven and principles-driven perspective. We have not changed, given political reality, we change based on what the facts on the ground are, right? So when migration changes, our recommendations change. And because of that, we have a credibility. So people who really want solutions, whether you're a Democrat or Republican, have reached out. It doesn't mean that it's going to be a priority for them. It doesn't mean that they're necessarily going to implement it, but they're willing to have a conversation.
Do you hear people agree?
Sometimes, yeah.
Do you hear people vehemently disagree?
Yes. And I vehemently disagree back.
Yeah.
Do you?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm not afraid to tell people when I think that they're wrong. And it's you know, it's not personal, right? It's a matter of policy. And I have said to policymakers before, you know, I don't think the policy that you are advocating for will actually help you achieve your goal. If your goal is what you stated is, I think that you can work towards it a different way. And here's what I would propose. And I've also told them when I think their facts are wrong. And I think that's important too. Sometimes people rely on bad facts.
Facts matter. It's good to know there's spirited debate though, because that's what it takes in a democracy to actually get to some solutions instead of just shutting each other out. My last one for you, Jen, is, you know, we touched on this just a little bit before we started. I always have a tendency, you know, Whiteley is always like setting up for the podcast, plugging in the microphones, doing all the heavy lifting with Daryl. And I'm sitting here just like shooting the breeze with whoever we're going to be speaking with. And the best stuff comes out then. We need to do a pre-podcast podcast. And you mentioned something and it just sticks out in my mind. We hear over and over again about people in this country angry about all of these people coming in through that southern border, and we can't even track them anymore. And then they overstay their visas here, and you know, we had to get them out of this country. You hear some similar things in Mexico about Americans.
This is good.
And I'll preface this by saying this came about because I was telling another one of my lost wallet stories, which happened in San Miguel de Allende. And I found out when I got to Guanajuato, I'd left my wallet. And lo and behold, somebody called my employer because they saw my business card in there. And they gave me my wallet back full of cash, by the way. And it was a Canadian couple living in San Miguel de Allende. It is a huge thing for Americans and Canadians to live in Mexico, but some of them are staying beyond their welcome too.
Well, yes, we now have around 2 million Americans living in Mexico.
Illegally?
Fun fact, almost half of them overstay their visas. So. But you know what? I don't think that's seen so much as a problem in Mexico. I think people are very aware that, you know, they're contributing to the community. And
but that happens here too, though. Well, Mexicans who come here and are working, in many cases paying taxes, et cetera. So that's the same. Why is it a different perception?
So here's where we go back to the changing conditions. You are now starting to hear some people along the Mexican border say, oh, well, you know, I don't know, all these immigrants, I'm not sure. I don't know if we want to employ them or not. I think it's human nature,
yeah.
Part of this, I don't know this situation, this culture, this factor, and this is how I externalize it. But I think that's why I go back. I think it's important. Dialogue matters, shared experiences matter, and I think that's how we have a better chance of working towards something.
Outsiders are looked at, though, with this skeptical eye, not just in the U.S. and in Mexico. This happens all over the world where you're seeing big migration patterns, you know, Germany, Italy, France, all of these same places are, you know, being roiled by this same conversation.
I think that when you look across multiple faiths, there's a similarity of, you know, there's a message to welcome the stranger. And that's because we need, a lot of faiths are about overcoming the sort of worst impulses of humanity. And so that's a common thread and has been for a long time. And, you know, differences, I think we're trained to feel that differences are a danger to us, and they really do enrich us. And so that's one of the things that we think is so important about immigration. And it's going to, anytime a country becomes a receiving country or even a transit country, it's going to be the sort of thing that upsets folks, at least until they kind of get used to the idea. If they see that integration and assimilation are working, which we know they work really well in the United States, those are things that really help. And so getting the community involved and making sure people are welcomed and adjusted, those are good things to do, and a way the private sector really works well.
Well, Mexico is one of the best places on earth, and so I get why all of those Americans are there illegally overstaying those visas. I've thought about it.
You don't hear that story, though. It's great.
You don't. And it's happening in reverse.
Right, it is. And with the guns going across, too, you know, we hear about the drugs coming from Mexico. We don't know who's coming across the border. Mm-hmm. Same thing as, you know, they're saying about the U.S., which I find fascinating.
Well, I lied to y'all. My last question turned into four each, and I also lied to y'all.
We have more to say, too, so, you know.
Yeah, that's true. It's y'all's fault, right? And I also lied to y'all in telling you that we would get you out if you're on time. We've overstayed our welcome, it turns out, too.
Laura Collins, thanks so much, and Jennifer Aperti. So we appreciate the
Aperti.
Insight.
It's Aperti.
Thank you.
We appreciate the insight. It's fascinating to learn this from people who study the policy and the people south of the border. So thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome back anytime.
Hey, y'all. Want to see the Jasons Talk Politics? Download the WFAA Plus streaming app for your smart TV. And watch the latest episode of Y'allitics each Wednesday night at 8:30.